Good morning. Welcome to The Talkies. I'm your host, Chris Welch. Happy Valentine's Day. Hope you're wearing red somewhere. Probably on your gums, at least. That'd be healthy. On the program today, we are going to be speaking of many things, actually. The Green New Deal. We'll end with that. The Valentine, I hope, to the planet. We'll keep our fingers crossed, figure out how we can make that happen. And we're going to also be talking about a lovely program that is part of, is going to be part of, President Barack Obama's My Brother's Keeper program. It's a local organization, and it's called the Hidden Genius Project, and the founder, Brandon Nicholson, is going to join us in studio to tell us all about that. And we begin with the very scary news, I believe. We're going to have our guest tell me just how scary, I'm sure. The topic of women's reproductive rights, this being V-Day, a day that has been made famous by Eve Ensler, making it a call to action on the subject of sexual abuse of women. But we are going to look at, speaking of sexual abuse of women, the move, the increasing moves, and the very scary success of those moves at limiting the reproductive rights of women in this country. Our guest is Jessica Mason Piclo. I'm always happy to talk to her with Rewire News, rewire.news, Vice President at the Law of Law and the Courts. And she's also the co-host of the Legal Analysis Podcast, Boom Lawyered, at rewire.news. Hey, Jessica, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me back. How are you?
I'm hanging in there, but I'm past childbearing years. And but I have a daughter and a granddaughter, and it's very scary. Kavanaugh was so disgusting, and then he got in, and then there came this vote. And he proved his colors, even though, oh, no, I wouldn't. So how bad is it, Jessica?
Oh, it's not great is how I will say it right now. So let's talk about this Louisiana case for a little bit.
And that's the one that was before the Supreme Court recently, yes.
Yes, yes. This is a Supreme Court case. And to give your listeners some context, the law at issue there was identical, basically, to the one in Texas that the Supreme Court just a few years ago in Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt decided was unconstitutional. And a little fun fact about this case is that when Louisiana was looking to pass the law, they looked to Texas and said, hey, this law has been so great and effective in closing abortion clinics. We want one of our own. I mean, they basically said the law closes clinics and that's why we want it. Anyway, the Fifth Circuit decided that it did, which is the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals that hears cases out of places like Louisiana, was going to let the law take effect. And the attorneys on behalf of the clinics petitioned the Supreme Court and said, this is really bad. We've got a really bad decision here, and the Fifth Circuit is going to let it take effect. At the least that you could do is tell the Fifth Circuit to just pause it for a minute, its decision. Don't let the law take effect, because we're going to petition you, Supreme Court, to take a look at it on the merits, right, to look at it for the meat of the matter, to see if it jives with Whole Woman's Health, this earlier decision. And the Supreme Court, up at the very last minute, decided that it would grant that request, that it would stay the Fifth Circuit decision. And that sounds like good news. And it is, in the immediate short term, good news. But when, as is often the case with the Supreme Court, when we take a step back and we see that there are a lot of other factors here. What are some of the factors here? Well, we have Judge Kavanaugh, and on his first substantive vote on abortion rights, he voted against them. And he didn't just vote against them. He decided to author a dissenting opinion that would have effectively let the law take effect. So ignoring precedent, which he said in his confirmation hearings was so critically important to him, would have allowed it to take effect, and also really sort of projected a pathway for conservative lawmakers in other states to move forward with testing the limits of the strength of Whole Woman's Health. So that's part of it. The other part is Chief Justice John Roberts, and he's a little bit of an enigma in this case because he voted with the liberals to pause the Fifth Circuit decision. And so that sounds like good news. And it is good news because the decision is paused. But I don't think that when push comes to shove, we will see Roberts decide to side with abortion rights in this case again. I think he took a conservative position, which was to leave things unchanged in terms of the landscape of the law. But should the court take this case on the merits, and that would happen in the fall, then we still have an opportunity for Chief Justice to do as he's always done, which is vote against abortion rights.
Mm.
So this is an important case because it is a temporary and important win, but it also shows some very dark winds blowing for reproductive rights at the court.
And is there anything anybody can do about it? I mean, when it's at this level and it's the Supreme Court and these guys are in there for life. Mm-hmm. What were the arguments coming from the other side? And if we can't, the irony of depending on John Roberts to protect us,
right,
or protect it, it's sort of disturbing. But what of the liberal, now minority on the court? What did they say? And you don't sound like we should have any hope on this particular case whatsoever.
Well, no, I won't say have no hope. So on the one hand, this case we can't read too much into what happened immediately in this case because it's very early in the process. Mm. The Supreme Court's decision was effectively a procedural vote. So there's not even an opinion from the liberal majority, for example. There's nothing that explains their reasoning other than, presumably the case met the legal standard of an emergency stay, which is what the specific request was. Now, the Center for Reproductive Rights, who are the attorneys representing the clinics in this case, they will now go and file a formal request with the court to take the Fifth Circuit's decision on the merits. And what I mean by that is really that's when they'll get into the legal arguments from both sides. But to give you a little preview of what that looks like, the legal arguments from the Center for Reproductive Rights are very straightforward. They say this Louisiana law is exactly like the Texas law, which you folks more or less in, same composition of folks at the Supreme Court that you decided was unconstitutional. So precedent and stare decisis, as legal terms that say prior court decisions matter and have a binding effect on future ones, precedent dictates that you block the Fifth Circuit here. That's a very straightforward case. What the state of Louisiana and conservative states who have jumped in to sort of rally for their cause, what they're arguing is effectively that whole woman's health is an important case, but it mostly just applies to Texas. And what needs to happen here is a very detailed factual analysis to determine just whether or not should the law take effect, clinics will close. And so they're really trying to slice the apple very thin on just how far this earlier win for abortion rights can go. And so the real question that's shaping up is what that means at the Supreme Court. Will John Roberts vote to uphold precedent? And if he does, then he votes to block the Louisiana law. Or will he vote as he did 3 years earlier in Whole Woman's Health and let the law take effect? He was in the majority in the case that we won, that abortion rights activists won before the Supreme Court. He would have let the Texas law take effect. So the question is, as Chief Justice, will he let the Louisiana law take effect?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now meanwhile, this is not the only case on this topic that is on its way to the Supreme Court, and we have, you've just mentioned Texas and Louisiana, then we have the House in Ohio passing the bill to criminalize abortions of fetuses with a heartbeat. We have all kinds of other restrictions coming in so that although Roe v. Wade, in theory, is still the law of the land, there's not much left of it, is there?
Not if conservatives have their way. It's very clear that conservative lawmakers in the states see an opening, and they have for a little while, but this is really a different, it's a different amplification than we've seen in the past. You mentioned Ohio's heartbeat bill. We've got, and these are bills that would ban abortion as soon as 6 weeks. In many cases, folks don't even know they're pregnant. I for sure did not know I was pregnant in my second pregnancy by the time I was 6 weeks, and I had already gone through it once. You'd think I would, but this is just how restrictive they are. Mm. And they are effectively total abortion bans, is how they play out. And by the time in Ohio's case, for example, let's say you happen to catch yourself in that 6 week window, well, then you still have to navigate all the other requirements like the 24-hour waiting period and so on and so forth. And many places have extended waits to try and even get an appointment. So you're timed out, which is how it works as an abortion ban. Mm. But they conservative lawmakers see an opening. They see an opening with the confirmation of Kavanaugh that he is almost a guaranteed fifth vote. I say almost to hedge, but I really think he is.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're going for the brass ring this legislative session. Not only are we seeing these six-week bans, we're seeing more and more states, places like Arkansas, for example, is advancing a bill that says should a decision overturn Roe v. Wade, then and as soon as the ink is dry on that decision, abortion is criminalized in Arkansas.
Wow.
So there are states that are ready to go immediately, and conservative, that is the reality of our landscape right now. And, you know, the counterpoint to that is there are places like New York and New Mexico and Colorado and California and Washington that are passing affirmative protections for reproductive rights. But that's great, but it's also not how it should be. This is, you know, our rights are not dependent on which state we live, but that is the map that is happening at the moment.
See, I was just going to ask you, where should I move? I don't have to in California, but... What states are safe for women? Because looks like my homeland of the Midwest is just, they're falling like dominoes right and left here.
It's hard. I'm a Midwesterner by birth and raised, you know, born and raised in Nebraska, went to college in the Midwest in Wisconsin, and lived in Minnesota for almost 20 years. It's a, you know, before coming back out west, it's hard to see places that you love and mean so much to you go in those directions.
Yeah, it's very scary.
It is. It's scary. And it's really scary because, you know, you will hear folks say, well, you should just move. And the reality is people, A, shouldn't have to move. But B, that's not possible for so many, and particularly the ones who are most impacted by these kinds of restrictions. What we are seeing in terms of good news, though, is that states that had historically been very hostile to reproductive rights are turning the corner, too. And even I'm talking about places like Kansas. Lawmakers are still trying to pass ridiculous measures in the state, but the makeup of the state legislature has changed such that they will not have the same success. And the Kansas state courts have been very supportive of reproductive rights.
Wow.
You know, in particular right now in this moment, my home state of Colorado is doing some excellent proactive legislating to protect reproductive rights and to really enshrine not just abortion, but access to contraception, access to non-biased information about reproductive rights generally. So that includes bans on things like conversion therapy that are just so harmful and abusive to our LGBTQ youth. Things like that. New Mexico is doing some really great work in the legislature there. Arizona is purpling. So there's hope in places that had historically been conservative. But, you know, the reality is, you mentioned Ohio, Mississippi, Kansas, Kentucky, Tennessee, it is relentless in the push. That's
mm-hmm.
for sure.
I neglected you. The cases that you were discussing that are before the that's been before the Supreme Court were about clinics, and I wanted to know what the status of those are. And I know they're definitely. Then you would definitely want to move because there's no clinic at all in some states.
Yeah, so right now the good news is that the Texas case that we won, Whole Woman's Health, that's that's still good law. That's the law of the land. And even this Louisiana law, those are blocked. So we are in a state, we are in a stasis right now in terms of that particular attempt to close clinics. One of the areas of concern for me in particular are the number of bans that we are seeing and that are advancing and that the Supreme Court could weigh in on their constitutionality targeting later abortions, mostly second trimester abortions, D&E bans. These are the safest form of later abortion, and over 20 states have bans on the books, and there's a case that the Supreme Court might take up, and might is always the name of the game with the court. There's no way to sort of know, but conservatives are really pushing the court to take up a case out of Alabama that is a D&E ban, and it's a pre-viability ban, and this is one that has a lot of concern for me, because should the court buy conservatives' argument, then we have effectively taken out another method of practice for abortion providers. And what we're doing is driving patients into more and more limited and more dangerous situations, all in the name of this quote unquote pro-life message. And it's really at an apex.
You're listening to Jessica Mason Piclo, who is Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire News, rewire.news, which is where you will get all kinds of great information on the topic of women's rights, reproductive rights. She's also the co-host of their legal analysis podcast, Boom Lawyered. And so rewire.news is where to go. And before we let you go, you mentioned some good news. What are people, what's the state of activism around all of this?
I am hopeful by the state of activism. We are seeing, you know, the legislative pushback that I mentioned in states out here in the Southwest and in places like New York. But, you know, if there is a silver lining, it is that the overreach by states and the Trump administration has really reinvigorated the protest movement against this. And so not just through action in state houses, but we're seeing, you know, protests on the street. We are seeing activists getting information out to patients who need it, how to do, you know, self-managed legal abortion on their own. You know, it is a democratizing of information. So that is hopeful. It is still very dangerous and scary times, though.
Indeed. Jessica, thanks so much for taking some of your time today to talk to us. I always appreciate it. You know a whole lot, and we really benefit from it. Jessica Mason Piclo, rewire.news. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Don't go away. We're going to be talking with Brandon Nicholson next.
Sometimes when I'm in a mood, I think of animals I might have been. I could have been a wombat or a goose. I could have been a monkey or a moose. I could have been a dragon or a horse that pulls a wagon, but I'm not. So what? Let others be a lion or a lamb. I'm proud to be the creature that I am. I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow.
Proud, 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 proud.
I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow.
Proud, 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 proud.
My skin
proud
is soft as silk. I give a lot of milk. I never pull a wagon or a plow. I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow.
Proud, 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 proud.
I'm glad that I say moo and not meow.
Meow.
My eyes are soft and dreamy. My butter's rich and creamy. I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow. I could have been a butterfly, they're pretty. I could have been a cockroach in the city. I could have been an, I know, I could have been a rhino. But I'm not.
She's not.
So what? I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow.
Proud, 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 proud,
I'm proud, 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 proud
proud to be a cow. Have horns upon my head. A meadow is my bed. I think that every cow should take a bow. I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow. I'm glad that I say moo and not bow wow. I'm proud I have an udder like my father. No, my mother. I'm proud, 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 proud to be a cow.
Okay. I love that song. This is from Sesame Street, and I was I wanted to play it for a Valentine's gift for everybody. This is a song, one of the, it turned out, lamentably, too few CDs that I had in the car on the 10-hour drive from Los Angeles back to the Bay Area the Saturday after Thanksgiving. And so I've heard this song many, 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 many times, and it never fails to make me smile. Perhaps that's because I'm a Taurus. Hello.
See what you did there. Cows and Tauruses.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Brandon Nicholson, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Very happy to meet you and glad that you're here. Brandon is the genius behind the Hidden Genius Project. And maybe you should just tell us what that is, first of all.
Sure. And thank you for allowing the time, and I appreciate it. Again, my name is Brandon Nicholson. I'm executive director of the Hidden Genius Project. Our mission is to train and mentor black male youth in technology creation, entrepreneurship, and leadership skills to transform their lives and communities. And our organization was founded in 2012 in Oakland, California, right down the road. And we now have programming that spans the globe, but our core programming, our most intensive programming, is based in Oakland and in Richmond. But we're very fortunate to have had a number of supporters and be part of a great community that's helped us, you know, serve now over 4,000 young people since our inception.
And doing what exactly?
That's a great question. So I think first and foremost, we're a youth development organization. We're trying to help elevate the potential and the, I think, empowerment of young people. But the means by which we do that, for example, in our most intensive program, which is our immersion program, as we call it, it's a 15-month program for black male and black male high school students. Uh-huh. Yes, and we teach them, you know, fundamentals of computer science and entrepreneurship and business, as well as leadership, which includes issues pertaining to the identity development, social justice, community engagement, and then that all culminates in them developing their own software projects or final projects that, you know, you would typically call what they say a full stack, or, you know, it's got a front end and a back end, but also centered on some idea that they've had. And the best cases, certainly that they address some community challenge more broadly, but in all cases, and very importantly still, that they represent and reflect the young people's own personal interests and passions.
So give me a for instance of what maybe some one young man or two young men have chosen to do with this.
Sure.
Support. What has been a project?
Yeah, there have been many, and you know, my mind is racing because I always think about, we have some examples that we go to right away that have become, you know, more prominent because of what those young men are doing and as alumni in our program. But one, you know, that's always fun to talk about is from a young man who was in our second cohort in Oakland, Muhammad. So he actually joined in 2013, and as he was completing his final project, this was actually in 2014 when he was working on it, but really interesting story. He's actually from Yemen, and his family's from Yemen. He came actually as an early adolescent to the States, right? So making an adjustment in that respect, and also making some cultural adjustments.
Big time, yeah.
So one thing that was culturally different for him was seeing his peers and his brothers, as he would call them, from the U.S. Who had such a passion for sneakers, and not just a passion for sneakers, but a passion for accumulating more and more of them, right? And so there's a young man in his cohort who would just have basically new Jordan sneakers every week. And at the same time, this young man, Muhammad, the young man who's built this project, he was also learning through our program about financial capability and financial literacy and the importance of saving and accumulating and setting goals. So he said, this seems to run counter to what I'm learning. Like, I want to help my brother like find more ways to save money. So he ended up making his software project called Spend Wisely, which was this idea that he would build a platform where you could enter items and products and things that you like or have an interest in, and that his web app could help you identify things and items that would relate to your interests, but for less money. So he figured that if I couldn't encourage my friend to buy less stuff, maybe I could just encourage him to spend less on it, and maybe that way he would save because he still wants the things.
Hey, but step by step.
Exactly. That's always a fun idea. And we've had a number of young people come up with some amazing, ideas ranging from projects that help them engage more peacefully and hopefully more amicably with law enforcement to projects that help them, figure out what they want to wear to school the next day. And so that's always been great. And I think then another part of our work, honestly, beyond just our intensive programming, is just to build opportunities for young people to recognize that their interests are, central and critical. So I'd say just in terms of what we do, whether it's in our intensive programming, some of the programming we do in schools, some of the single day events we do, or even some of the programming now where we have some of our alumni teaching workshops for youth in the community and in partnership with other community organizations that serve young people. The thread that underlies all that is that at this time in our lives, this is a great time to figure out what do you love and what do you think you might be good at? And then can you explore the array of possibilities and pathways that might be around that, even the ones that you may not know that well. And that can be the thing that helps someone get to do something they had no idea that they might do. But what usually doesn't work, especially for adolescents, not to put them in a box, but is telling them that what you're interested in is not the thing that you should follow my idea, right?
So. Yeah. Brandon Nicholson. Well, so how did you get to decide that you wanted to do something like the Hidden Genius Project? It would appear from your presentation and your articulateness that you had a lot of support or opportunities, but I could be wrong about that. How did you come to do this, and what's your backstory?
Sure. I'm very fortunate. I've had a wealth of opportunities and support over the years.
Amen.
Without question. And, definitely have a great affinity for this place, quite literally this station, certainly, but just where we are. I grew up in Oakland, and, family member of and friend of multiple Golden Bears, right? And I'm also an alum myself of the School of Education, a doctoral program, particularly in policy and measurement and evaluation in the UC Berkeley School of Ed. So I grew up actually in Oakland, deeply concerned about access to opportunity. And I went to Oakland schools, kindergarten through eighth grade, and then attended a independent school in Marin County, Marin Academy, for high school, and I commuted out there. So that really solidified my interest in educational equity and access to opportunity. And it wasn't just the disparity, say, between our school, which is, now upwards of, $45,000 a year to attend. But also just looking at, just by virtue of being in a different county and zip code, even the quote unquote least resourced or poorer schools in Marin County, had more than, double the resources you'd see at many of the schools here in the East Bay, right, at the public school. So I always was interested in pursuing areas of around, and pathways around how to address that. And so I ended up, studying public policy in undergraduate and then graduate school. And then for a while, almost 5 years, I was working at a policy research and evaluation firm So I was learning a lot about how organizations work and how to measure effectiveness of programs and also how philanthropy works, how government funding works and the like. So those all became helpful skills over time. But it was really the brainchild of colleagues of mine and friends of mine from a program called the Ron Brown Scholar Program. And so that's a scholarship program for young people of African descent entering undergraduate education, named for the late Ronald H. Brown, the former Secretary of Commerce under the Clinton administration. And this particular scholarship, you know, was meant to bring young people together to build these lifelong networks for social change and really emphasize the power of all, as they say. So, it was about $40,000 unrestricted scholarship funds for each student, which was great. But the idea was come for the money and stay for the relationships. And so I was very fortunate to have two colleagues. They both attended Harvard University, and one was from Inglewood. The other was from Cincinnati, two black young men who became best friends and came out to Oakland to build their own for-profit entity called Mind Blown Labs and teach young people financial capability skills. So in the process of doing that and being in Oakland, they wanted to pay it forward at the same time. So even as they were building a for-profit startup, they also then elected to then build this nonprofit startup at the same time without a real infrastructure or budget or perhaps even knowledge of what they were doing, you know. But they came to me and said, there's something I wanted to do. And so it was going to be a volunteer-driven organization for the first 2.5 years, as it turned out. And so I volunteered just in terms of trying to help design some of the assessments and educational components and just supporting and networking, advocating however I could. And then over time, even as we had this great labor of love and this great legacy as an organization that was doing it for all the right reasons, that's not enough to keep it going, right? So we realized we were going to need an infrastructure.
That sounds very familiar.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. Shout out to KPFA and public radio. Yeah, so I had that great opportunity to come on as the first executive director and then been able to build from there. And now, you know, we went from having no staff and no budget, and I came on over 4 years ago, and now we've got 10 full-time staff and, you know, serving exponentially more young people now. So I'm really proud of that.
Cool. And you're going to be part of this Bay Area launch of with Steph Curry and John Legend and Barack Obama.
Right. Yeah.
Of the
of
the My Brother's Keeper project. And that's next week, this week coming up?
Next week, starting next Monday.
How did that connection get made? It sounds completely logical to me.
Sure.
That it would have been made, but and then what's gonna happen next week?
Yeah, it's an fascinating thing. The My Brother's Keeper initiative came out and surfaced during the Obama presidency in partnership with a number of philanthropic executives, foundation executives, and community organizers and stakeholders who were all making an explicit and formal and out loud commitment to supporting the well-being of young men and boys and young men of color, recognizing that, you know, all of us need help, all of us need support, and absolutely our sisters and colleagues, you know, across gender identities and across racial lines need support. That having been said, that, you know, there was any number of, you know, concerning trends, particularly as it pertained to black and Latino young men and also certainly our, you know, Southeast Asian and indigenous young men as well. But just making a commitment to say, hey, we have to actually be proactive in building and supporting work that is going to empower these young people to thrive and flourish over time. And so as a result, that initiative came about, and a lot of different cities made their own commitments to support, you know, the work, or at least convene organizations and stakeholders who are supporting boys and young men of color. Oakland certainly was one of those cities. But then over time, honestly, communities, right? The work was already being formed and shaped and defined by the people in those communities doing that work. So, in probably fewer cases, My Brother's Keeper probably was not, you know, driving the creation or development of work to support boys and young men men of color, but rather elevating its importance and its visibility and making a case to then support and sustain it. And so over time, then, of course, we moved on in terms of our executive office representation, as some of you might have heard or even lamented.
Sadly.
And, of course, then the launch of the Obama Foundation came about. And so one of its primary charges is to continue this My Brother's Keeper work and elevating that work. So next week is a summit then. And actually, it's pulling, I think, nationally, if not internationally, organizations and stakeholders and folks who are actually committed to supporting boys and young men of color. So we're very fortunate to be at the table with our partners who drove the application process for us to try and acquire one of the Obama Foundation grants. And so the Rise Youth Center in Richmond, which is doing tremendous work for young people, it's one of our core partners.
Right down the street from our house.
There you go.
Yeah,
and so it's a tripartite partnership between RISE, who's our backbone, and then an Office of Neighborhood and Safety, which has gained national notoriety as a program that's supporting violence prevention by addressing the holistic needs of the young people who are actually committing those acts or possibly at risk of committing those acts, but at opportunity of doing such great things if they had the supports and resources. So we're very proud to be in that partnership. And as a result of us in winning a seat award in that Obama Foundation competition, then, you know, each of our organizations got a seat at the table, so to speak, for next week, where they'll be having summits, also including young people from the area and young people from outside the area who are, you know, participating in these summits and, you know, programs about how we're making our commitments and doing our work to support boys and young men of color.
And I know that the work and the commitment and all that is why you're doing it, and that's what it's about. But are you going to get to meet Barack?
You know, I'm sure that's the million-dollar question for everyone, and I think I would certainly love to meet President Obama if I could. You know, I'm tempering expectations because I recognize that's going to be priority one for everyone. But I think it's just going to be really exciting to be in the space and to be able to connect with stakeholders. There's people we've connected with in Los Angeles and LA and Chicago, Atlanta and Chicago, who plan to be there and who say, "I'll see you next week." And so that's really exciting as well, to just build community
that
time.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That's big. You're listening to Brandon Nicholson, and his organization is the Hidden Genius Project. And how do people find out about it? What's your website or whatever?
Sure, you can definitely check us out. You can always use your favorite search engine, whatever that might be, to look us up. But you can find us at www.hiddengeniusproject.org. And we're certainly on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. And so if you search us there, you'll find us, and you can definitely keep up with us. We've had some great support and growth in our communications, thanks to the likes of Precious Stroud and PGS.
I was going to say, you came in here with a very wonderful and heavy-hitting woman, Precious
Stroud.
She's
big time.
Whom I was fortunate enough to interview a while ago about her group. And you, Precious, step up here to this microphone. You said, as it falls off, you said that this group is one of your projects.
Yes.
So what does that mean?
So PGS Consultants helps nonprofits and new initiatives and government agencies tell their stories. And through the last 6 or 8 years, starting with the African American Male Achievement Program in Oakland Unified, have a focus on narrative change in the field of Black male achievement. So we're really excited about this conversation that's happening, as well as seeing many of the people who we've worked with over the last 6 to 8 years be invited to this very special opportunity.
Really? And of course, if I were crass, I would say, what are you going to wear? But
a tie, for sure. I'll definitely have a tie on. We'll see about the rest.
Oh, boy. Well, so I'm so grateful to meet you. And Precious, thank you so much for, you weren't the connection, but since you're connected, I'm even more happy to meet you.
Well, beautiful.
Because I really think the world of her.
Yeah.
So what can people do to help you in your work or whatever?
Well, thank you for asking. I appreciate that. I think, our work has only grown on the backs of our collaboration and our partnerships and all the folks who've supported us. So there's been so many ways that people have done that and continue to do so. One of which is, I think, just continuing to spread the word. If you look us up and you like what you see, for example, our applications for our intensive program are open right now. And we're especially looking to get more applications in from West Contra Costa County. So Richmond and the corridor up, 80, headed, east,
yep,
as it were.
Exactly.
And we actually pull young people all the way from Fairfield and Pittsburgh and Antioch as well. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So certainly, spread the word there because our application's open for the next week or so. And then, of course, you can always volunteer with us or, just reach out and you can get more information on our website about opportunities there. And, for those of you who are so inclined and you've already done making your donations to KPFA or any other, public radio stations, then you can certainly support the Hidden Genius Project. And we're happy to make great use and expand our impact and scale our impact through your resources. And so I think those are the big three. But honestly, just from those three things, there's always so many more great ideas and great opportunities, initiatives that we're able to do that come as a result just of building community. So the more folks we have on our team and supporting us and, again, who are spreading the word, the better.
Brandon Nicholson, NICHOLSON, Brandon Nicholson, the Hidden Genius Project, hiddengeniusproject.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And don't go away. We're going to talk about the planet next. The extent, severity, pace, and closing window of opportunity to avoid potentially catastrophic outcomes has led many scientists to conclude that we have entered a new era of rapid environmental change. We define this as the age of environmental breakdown to better highlight the severity of the scale, pace, and implication. This is a new study from the Institute for Public Policy Research in the UK. half the carbon being flooded into the atmosphere is being produced by the richest 10% of the world. The Earth's natural systems are being destabilized jointly and faster than ever. Since 1750, we accomplished change in only 268 years, humans. I mean, that in past eras had taken tens of thousands of years. And since 1950, the number of floods across the world has increased by 15 times, extreme temperature events by 20 times, wildfires sevenfold, global vertebrate populations. We are vertebrates. This just in. Global vertebrate populations have fallen by 60% since the 70s. And the invertebrates are doing worse. 70% of insects have been killed in just the last 50 years. A third of insect species are threatened with extinction. There may be none left a century from now. And topsoil is now being lost 10 to 40 times faster than it is being replenished by natural processes. And since the mid-20th century, 30% of the world's arable land has become unproductive due to erosion. In other words, we desperately need the Green New Deal, and we need it like yesterday. So says Juan Cole in a piece that appeared on Common Dreams the other day. And, of course, we do. The good news is that we have a Green New Deal. It was just introduced by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey of Mass, and it was introduced last week. And since then, of course, Donald Trump, Republican lawmakers, right-wing pundits, has been spreading all kinds of hysterical falsehoods, and Mitch McConnell is forcing a quick vote, which he hopes is going to divide the Democrats. And most people say, no, it's going to make you look like an idiot, because the vast majority of the population is in favor of this thing. And he says, we're going to vote in the Senate and see how many Democrats want to end air travel and cow farts, which is not what it's about. To find out what it is, what about, and what we can do about it, we have joining us on the telephone, I'm happy to say, Arvind Reddy, who is a writer and activist with Sunrise Bay Area. Sunrise, the youth movement behind the Green New Deal. Hello to you, Arvind.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Well, I'm pretty good, but maybe I'm in denial. With all of what I just read, it's absolutely stunning what we have in front of us. What? Tell me about the plans to... Mr. McConnell is hoping that this is pushing for a fast vote on this resolution that has just been introduced will destroy it and the Democrats. What's the Sunrise movement planning to do to stop that possibility?
I think what we're trying to do right now is to encourage the general public to be contacting their senators, regardless of whether or not they are Democratic or Republican senators. Just contacting your senators and asking them to support the Green New Deal resolution, whether through going to their offices or calling their phone lines or just sending in letters or emails. I think it's important that, as you were mentioning, the majority of the American public support what scientists and are saying, is that they support not only that climate change is occurring, but that we need to do something very urgently about it. So I think that while Mitch McConnell is trying to push this vote, Sunrise is trying to encourage the public to call their senators and ask them to support the Green New Deal, not only to show to Mitch McConnell that the Democrats will not be divided on such an issue as climate change, but also that the American public will be holding their elected officials responsible for ensuring that the American public and at large humanity stays alive and not be affected by ever worsening effects of climate change.
You guys had an emergency mass call just last night. I'm sorry that I missed that, but I'm sure you're going to have another one to discuss plans to make the Senate Majority Leader regret his scheme. Meanwhile, what they have said is they've decried this whole thing as a socialist fever dream, much less the cow farts. And Mr. Trump, just in El Paso this week said, I really don't like their policies of taking away your car, taking away your airplane flights. You're not allowed to own cows anymore. We just played a cow song, and maybe we'll play it again because I love it so much. What does the New Deal really have in it, the Green New Deal?
Sorry, can you say one question more time? Sorry.
What is in the Green New Deal? They're saying that it's going to ban airplanes and take your car away and stop cows from farting.
Those messages that the president and the Senate Majority Leader are putting out are simply tools of distraction to avoid talking about the real issue at hand. In this case, what the Green New Deal is calling for, it's calling for a plan for a just transition to a decarbonized economy over 11 years. Now, it's not going to outright ban all fossil fuels. So in response to the claims made by the president and the Senate Majority Leader, air travel is still an issue that we need to determine how best to phase on to make it more into a renewable form of energy to power airplanes. But speaking to the larger issue at hand is that the Green New Deal is the only solution we have right now to tackle this immense problem of climate change that is threatening humanity as we know it. And they use such language not only as a way to distract the public, but also to draw attention away from their own connections to fossil fuel industries, where they were seeing political donations from such companies. For example, Senate Majority Leader has received $1.9 million from oil and gas billionaires and companies and campaign donations. And they know that if the Green New Deal does pass, not just as a resolution but as a bill, they'll be seeing their own profit margins and their own donations and political power decreasing because fossil fuel executives' powers will be curtailed as well.
Mm. I'm looking at Naomi Klein's piece on this. Also, I found on Common Dreams, the battle lines have been drawn on the Green New Deal, and she's the one who quoted Mr. Trump's remarks. And she says, it's worth marking this moment because these could be the famous last words of a one-term president, having wildly underestimated the public appetite for transformative action. And she mentions the triple crises of our time. Number one, imminent ecological unraveling. Number two, gaping economic inequality, including the racial and gender wealth divide, and three, surging white supremacy. And she says that this Green New Deal could introduce, this is a clear Democratic mandate, Democratic small d, to introduce wartime levels of investment to battle our triple crises from day one. So it's about putting your money where the non-fossil fuel is, other kinds of energy, among other things. Is that mm-hmm. right? I haven't read the thing.
No, that's absolutely correct. The plan is to, so as at the moment, it's a resolution. So it's a proposal just to see where, as Ms. Klein was mentioning, where different balances are being drawn, where people are falling on the side of either supporting the Green New Deal or not supporting the Green New Deal. In this case, the Green New Deal itself is calling for a transition away from fossil fuels towards renewable source of energy. Future bills, because there'll be many bills, just as it's called the Green New Deal, just like the FDR's New Deal, mm-hmm. this will involve many bills over time to require, figure out the different aspects of how to transition the entire American economy to a completely carbon neutral economy, while also making sure that it's a just transition that respects how frontline communities, indigenous communities, historically marginalized communities, and non-white communities who have historically been oppressed are making sure that they have a just transition in their name, that they're not being pushed to the side, as did occur with the New Deal under FDR.
Yeah. And, okay, remind us about the Sunrise Movement, its origins and its purpose.
The Sunrise Movement was founded about a year and a half ago by activists who were coming from various environmental movements, both veteran organizations as well as more youth-led movements such as the divestment movements to move college campuses away from oil, to divest away from oil companies, as well as Standing Rock and the bravery of the indigenous people there. Mm. So Sunrise was founded to determine, given what we know about climate change, that we just have 12 years, not 12 years to have a plan in 2030, but 12 years to implement the plan, how can we use both people power as well as political power to justly transition this economy into one where everyone will have good green jobs that provide sustainable living wages, and no one is left behind in this transition.
And where can we find out more about the Sunrise? And where, what are, and you're suggesting that everybody call there. Are you going to have another emergency mass call?
At the moment, in terms of like emergency mass calls, they're still scheduling to determine when the next best time is.
Okay.
But as of now, for the next week or so, what Sunrise is recommending is that all people who are listening to this call to not only call their senators' offices and to contact their senators to support this Green New Deal resolution, but to do the same for their representatives, as the Democrats hold the majority in the House. And furthermore, that to talk to your fellow neighbors, talk to your teachers, talk to whoever you know, talk to them about climate change. And while it may seem overwhelming, the amount of energy that needs to be put into this to justly transition the economy, it's a necessary act we must do, not only for our generations, but for future generations, to ensure that we all have a livable future.
That's right. That's right. It's not a matter of, well, yeah, let them do it. It's got to be done now. Arvind, I thank you so much for joining us. Arvind Reddy, who is a writer and activist with Sunrise Bay Area. Thank you so much for spending some of your morning with us.
Thank you, Chris. I hope you have a good day.
You too. Happy Valentine's. And may it be a happy Valentine to the planet, this new Green New Deal. And shall we do what we can about it? I have one more. I have an announcement about something happening today. And this was the Vince Ramos Brigade that mentioned it. On Valentine's Day, join us to ask Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase to break up with private prisons. So they break their relationship. These are the biggest operators. They continue to fund GEO Group and Core Civic, who are the biggest operators of private prisons and immigrant detention centers. And so folks are demonstrating in front of Wells Fargo, and they're meeting today at noon at the Wells Fargo by Embarcadero BART in San Francisco. I thank you for listening. Have a wonderful Valentine's Day and weekend. And big ups to Kristen Thomas at Controls. And one more time with the cow song.
Sometimes when I'm in a mood, I think of animals I might have been. I could have been a wombat or a goose. I could have been a monkey or a moose. I could have been a dragon or a horse that pulls a wagon, but I'm not. So what? Let others be a lion or a lamb. I'm proud to be the creature that I am. I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow.
Proud, 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 proud,
I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow.
Proud, 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 proud,
my skin
proud.
Is soft as silk. I give a lot of milk. I never pull a wagon or a plow. I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow.
Proud, 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 proud,
I'm glad
proud.
That I say moo and not meow.
Meow.
My eyes are soft and dreamy. My butter's rich and creamy. I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow. I could have been a butterfly, they're pretty. I could have been a cockroach in the city. I could have been an, I know, I could have been a rhino. But I'm not.
She's not.
So what? I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow. A cow. Have horns upon my head. A meadow is my bed. I think that every cow should take a bow. I'm proud, proud, proud to be a cow. I'm glad that I say moo and not bow wow. I'm proud I have an udder like my father. No, my mother.
I'm proud, 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 proud to be a
You are listening to 94.1 KPFA Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF Fresno, 97.5 K248BR Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. Your local station board election is happening. Visit elections.pacifica.org to find out about the candidates, members like you who want to help keep KPFA alive. Look for your ballots starting January 18th via email or postal mail. Vote as soon as you can. Ballots must be received by March 5th. Have questions about your eligibility, the voting process, or need a replacement ballot? Email the National Election Supervisor at nes@pacifica.org. Thank you.